Hello and welcome back to the Fiction Hack podcast. I think we're on episode 4 now. My name's Colin Munro and this is Ross Lawhead.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Doing well. I'm looking forward to this episode because I love something that you hate. And that's going to make for some great content.
Yeah. Now, before we get into that, though, last week we did an episode and we forgot to mention how people can find us off of this podcast. Do you want to give us your Twitters and all that?
Yeah, mine are really easy. It's just my name. It's at Ross Lawhead, all one word. I'm on YouTube, but I haven't uploaded anything for a while. So if you're listening to this now, check it out. If you're listening to this in the future, I've probably got some more stuff up there. And yep. I've got a website as well, rosslawhead.com.
And your blog is superb, I might add.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, and I you can find me on Twitter. I'm Colin_Munro, and that's Munro spelled M-U-N-R-O.
Not the proper way.
The proper way, the proper Scottish way. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I've also got a website, but that's in a... It's a brand new WordPress installation. So right now, but obviously if you're listening to this in the future, it's going to be amazing and it's all going to be about the podcast. That's where you're going to find all the show notes. At least my version of the show notes. I think, are you going to do your own version of the show notes?
I haven't decided yet. They may be illustrated or they may just not exist.
Okay. Well, we'll see how that goes. Okay. So let's get straight into this episode then. Right, this episode is about why I hate Charles Dickens.
Yeah, you've kind of dropped that on me without much warning, because I did not know that you were not a fan of Dickens.
Right. Well, what's there to be a fan of? I mean, okay, you're going to tell me. That's what this episode is.
No, you make your case first.
Yes, I am going to make my case first.
All right. Okay, no, you go for it. Just tell
me. I'm going to go for it.
Lead in, and then give me your reasons.
Yeah, let me go into this, and don't interrupt me. And then I'll let you tell me, I'll let you, you know, rebut. Okay, so...
I love rebutting, by the way.
Yeah. Now, so I was actually trying to thinking about this, doing a bit of research, and I was trying to find out, you know, why I don't like this. And I found somebody online who's written a blog post who pretty much sums up exactly what I was thinking. His name's Noah Murphy, and his website's K23 Detectives. Anyway, he talks about it. If you read like the first paragraph or the first page of Oliver Twist, you know, you can really see that it's just such a load of nonsense. It makes me so angry just reading it, because he uses so many words that he doesn't need to. He talks in kind of riddles. He doesn't just say what he wants to say. You know, he was, and obviously it's no secret that he was being paid by the word, and you can tell because he was milking it. I think what is going to be an interesting thing in this episode is also the concept that he talks about in his blog post of Chekhov's gun. Now, Chekhov's gun is basically talking about how if you've got a gun in... I think the playwright Chekhov said, if you've got a gun on stage in the first act, then it needs to go off in the second act or something along those lines, right?
If you've got a gun, all bets are off.
Yeah.
If you've got a gun, sit down and listen to me. No.
Hang on. I'm not finished yet. Okay. So that's Chekhov's gun.
I just got this image of Chekhov holding a gun. If you've got a gun.
But the point is that that you shouldn't just have stuff for no reason if it doesn't forward the story. Now, I know there's a lot of debate about this whole issue, and I'm not completely on the side of saying you shouldn't have stuff for no reason, because I remember listening to a Quentin Tarantino interview a few years ago where he was saying that's absolute nonsense, you know, because if you look at Reservoir Dogs, there's that scene at the beginning where they're all just talking and Mr. Pink says he doesn't tip and all that stuff, you know, and none of that's got anything to do with the story. The first like 15-20 minutes doesn't have anything to do with the overall plot. But it's all about character. It's all about establishing the characters. So I agree with Quentin Tarantino there that you can have stuff that doesn't forward the story, but it has to be there for a reason. And if, you know, that reason's got to be you know, it can be just to make your character, to tell you more about your characters, you know?
Yeah, well, which is an aim in and of itself. It's not right.
So with
aim,
that in mind, with those two things in mind, I'm going to read the first paragraph of Oliver Twist.
Ooh, I'm going to enjoy this. Okay.
And you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. So, among other public buildings in a certain town, which for many reasons it will be prudent to refrain from mentioning, and to which I will assign no fictitious name, there is one anciently common to most towns, great or small, to wit, a workhouse. And in this workhouse was born, on a day and date which I need not trouble myself to repeat, inasmuch as it can be of no possible consequence to the reader, in this stage of business at all events, the item of mortality whose name is prefixed by the head of this chapter. Blah, 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 blah. And I assume it goes on like that for another 500 pages. So, you know, basically, and this is something that Noah mentioned in his blog post. He basically translates that into normal, efficient English, saying, you know, among other nameless buildings in a nameless town, there was a workhouse. And in this workhouse, was a boy was born called Oliver. That's basically what he could have said. It would have been much more efficient. None of this nonsense, drivel. It gives me a headache.
Or even just Oliver was born in a workhouse.
Whatever, yeah. You know, basically, there's loads of ways of doing it better than what Dickens does.
Okay.
And that's my point. I rest my case. I don't think we need to say any more. See you next week.
Okay, so that's your entire case.
Pretty much.
Wow. Okay. I was expecting more. So, because I mean, there's a lot more criticisms of Dickens.
Okay.
What
else could I have said?
Well, I mean, have you read an entire book, or have you seen a televisual or filmic adaptation of any of them?
I saw the Muppets one.
Muppets one is good. Yeah, I like
Christmas
the
Muppets
Carol. Yeah, that's up there for me.
Uh-huh. I mean, like, why should I? He ruined it for me. I mean, I gave him a chance. I read the first page of Oliver. I'm not reading any more of that crap.
No, I get that. I'm just trying to find out the scope here of what we're dealing with. Because, I mean, with Oliver Twist, there's the constant criticism that everything is so coincidental at the end. You know, he just happens to come across this. You know, they just happen to burgle. Oh, it does happen in Oliver's Twist. They just happen to fall in with a crowd who burgles the house of the man whose daughter is his mother, and it all comes kind of around in such a roundabout fashion. Someone notices a portrait of the mother, and she's got the same chin as Oliver, or something like that. I don't know. I have read Oliver Twist. It's been a while, I have to say, and. All the things that people have kind of shown and written about Oliver Twist kind of gets jumbled up. All the adaptations as well.
Yeah,
because I am a fan of Dickens, and he does do that. I mean, of course, he's overwritten. I think everyone would agree on that to a degree.
Because of the whole pay by the word thing.
Well, I mean, people make a lot about that, but what writer isn't paid by the word?
Well, I mean.
I mean,
we all are,
to a degree.
No, you're not. Because, you know, you could write a novel that's 300 pages, or you could write a novel that's 800 pages, and it can be the same story, and the 800 pages just padded out with a load of nonsense, like Dickens.
Sure. No, I'm not defending him on that count. But, again, you know, it's all about where you draw the line. And Dickens is certainly very florid. And I think this is kind of what I was saying earlier, is that even though every word that he's got doesn't have direct influence on the plot or even on the character, a lot of it will be there to develop a mood of a piece. Although, I mean, just
a mood
just
of boredom.
Just hearing you read that, I mean, it's pretty insupportable. And we got to keep in mind that this was actually Dickens' second book that he wrote. And he was still kind of finding his feet. He does better towards the end, I feel.
Okay.
But even then, I do remember, because I first read Our Mutual Friend in English class when I was, about 15, 16. And he... we all got a huge headache about this character called Twemlo, about whether this was actually a person he was describing or a piece of furniture. It turned out it was a person, but he kept talking about it in furniture terms. And at no point did he actually kind of close off the metaphor and say, oh, no, this is actually a person we're talking about. He just kind of left it hanging there. So, you know, this is the first Dickens that we're kind of, you know, thrown at. And we honestly couldn't understand if this was an actual character or not. So, yeah, I mean, there are lots. And again, the coincidences keep coming through. Dickens was someone who would write very intuitively. He would often get into a bit of a bind with the resolution of his stories. And he would need to kind of agonize at length about, you know, how he was going to resolve all these different characters, how he's going to bring it back together. And Our Mutual Friend is an interesting one. G.K. Chesterton, who I love a lot and who loved Dickens a lot, said that Our Mutual Friend was, you know, is a book that everyone can't wait to finish. Even Dickens himself couldn't wait to finish it. But it is kind of one of the longer ones as well. And you get the feeling that he was quite rushed at the end, even at that. So I hear what you're saying about overwriting, and I can't defend that. And if that is something that you just can't get past, then I would say that you don't have to read a Dickens book at all your entire life. But it kind of bums me out to say that, because the things that Dickens does so well, and the reason that we still read him today and still, you know, he gets, you know, adapted, you know, what if his books has not been made into a movie or a TV series or a radio drama or something like that? The reason that we still, you know, go to him today is just that he grabs you. You know, I was thinking about this just in the last week when you announced, you know, what this topic was going to be, is I can't think of another writer, I should say, who has made me cry as often as Dickens has. And it hasn't been every book, and I'm not a crier by nature, but there have been some books that have just devastated me just in the middle of it. It's not the resolution of it. It's not how everything comes together. It's so beautiful, but just the way that he portrays the human condition as being something that's at the same time flawed and noble and strong and weak and admirable and despicable. It's like no one else. And it's not just because he's a product of his time. It's not just because of the, you know, getting paid by the word, because there were other writers that were doing that. Anthony Trollope is infinitely more readable. I like him a lot. I love his plots are very good. His characters are fantastic. I read, but, you know, at the same time, it is very hard for me to read Dickens for that reason, but also because of the pure emotion that he's able to just get from you. And it comes time in most of Dickens' books, the longer ones for sure, like Bleak House was like this, Little Dorrit was like this. There comes a time where I get halfway through and I just stop. And I feel emotionally that I'm kind of done with this book, because I've already gotten five times the emotional kick out of this book as I have any other book. And I'm looking at the rest of this and thinking, I don't know how I can keep going on, because, you know, I just need to take a break, essentially. And so I usually will for a few months and then come back to it, or maybe jump into an audiobook reading of it or something like that.
So do you think you get less when you do an audiobook than you do when you read it for real?
I think I get the same amount, but I know this is a very contentious topic. We could probably address this maybe in a question segment or something like that, because people have some very strong emotions about this, and so do I.
Yeah, I think different people's brains are wired in different ways, and you know, I'm going to confess, I don't read a huge amount, but I do listen to audiobooks, and it's just because I find sometimes when I'm reading, I just switch off and I'm looking at the words. But I stop and I, you know, my mind wanders. I start thinking about other things, and I'm kind of like, don't know what I just read the last five pages.
Yeah. So
I mean, maybe that happens. I know that happens to a lot of people, but
yeah. No, stop changing the subject.
Yeah.
Let's stick with this.
Okay.
Let's just take it for read that yes, it is the same as reading. Just let me off the
book. Okay.
If
yeah.
Else.
Yeah. For now. But for now. But the reason I mention that is because I think that affects my enjoyment of Dickens, because he's so wordy.
He is very wordy, yeah. And again, you know, I mean, there are different schools of thought when you come to writing. You know, should writing just be sparse? Should you not describe characters and let the, you know, audience see them? You know, should every plot development serve the overall plot? Or is there scope just for being... just for being extravagant, you know? And Dickens, I think, that's the word I'd use to describe him, is just extravagant. There are bits in there that you don't need. Just like, you know, in a fantastic meal, there are bits that you don't eat, you know, but you still have those on offer if you need to. You know, maybe that meal is especially rich and, you know, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to read only Dickens, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some friends at work today about Tolkien and Lord of the Rings and how the whole Tom Bombadil section could have been completely cut out and you wouldn't miss it. And in fact, they did that in the movie. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's the same thing. But I think with Tolkien, it's like he's enriching the world, and Middle Earth is like a character in the world. And I mean, he's always going off on tangents which don't feed the main plot. And I guess that makes it a bit more difficult to read, especially more so in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. But,
well, we were talking about this last week with Star Wars, you know. Wait, I did it. I brought it back to Star Wars, didn't I?
Every episode is going to have a Star Wars in it.
But, you know, it's world building, right? Because, you know, you throw in some bits that don't connect with this literal story that you're telling, and you get the impression that this is something larger is happening, something more is going on in this universe. And I think that's another appeal for reading it now, as to opposed to when Dickens actually wrote these books. You know, by and large, they're generally contemporary. You know, there are two historical novels that he wrote, Barnaby Rudge and A Tale of Two Cities. And then there are some books which take place about 10 years before they were actually written, which is pretty much, you know, it'd be like writing a book right now. It takes a place, you know, in 2008. It's pretty much, you know, modern time. But, you know, you get a different feel of what London was, you know, what Britain was. In that time, you know, 1860, 1870, whenever. So, you know, as a historical document, because it's got all those extra parts, that's an interest in itself. I mean, and, you know, you look at other, I think this is a product of the time of, you know, A, being paid for by the word, but also writing in installments, which we should remind ourselves that Dickens did. So he would write, you know, two or three chapters. Those would be published in a paper along with other stories, other news articles, that kind of thing. So he it's like, you know, writing episodes of a television series.
Yeah,
you know,
we were talking about, it's like the 24 last
time. Yeah.
So he'd actually begin to get feedback from his audience.
Yeah.
On the first few chapters.
Colin, more than that.
Few chapters,
yeah, there was, I think it was it The Old Curiosity Shop or one of his books? He overheard a couple of women ahead of him in the queue, probably in the post office or something, talking about his book and saying, oh, I wonder how it's going to wrap up. I wonder what's going to happen to this character. I wonder what's going to happen to this character. And then he reports thinking, oh, yes, I should probably figure that out, because it's going to end pretty soon. So, yeah, he was very much seat of the pants. And, you know, again, you know, a lot of the great novels of that time were written that way, not just in Britain, but in France. You know, Alexandre Dumas, he was writing, you know, Three Musketeers in installments. Eugène Sue was writing The Wandering Jew in installments, which is very popular, which we've all forgotten about now. Les Miserables, that was written in installments. And I would say that Victor Hugo in Les Miserables takes way wilder flights of fancy than Dickens ever did. There are some bits which have now been appendicized with Les Miserables. If you get the unabridged edition, they just stick them at the back because they've got absolutely nothing to do with the story about life in a convent in this place. At one point, he just goes into the Battle of Waterloo, and then at the end, you figure out how that ties in. But I still think that was pretty self-indulgent. You know, Victor Hugo would just, you know, write an essay about something, historical even, and it wouldn't really kind of feed into the story at all. Again, I think that's a little bit unforgivable.
Well, I didn't say it was just Dickens I dislike.
Cardinal. No, I'm getting that sense. But, I mean, that's a cardinal sin right now, but it was not back then, you know, because these were learned men. They were writing to an audience which was not 100% literate. You know, these would be read out kind of to the family. So if there was one literate family member, they would, you know, these stories would be disseminated to a more illiterate population. And again, you know, I think an attraction to them would have been a more poetic type of writing. So I think there was a market for that.
I mean, this is the thing people say about Shakespeare, is that actually, you know, he's seen as highbrow now, but back in the day, back in his day, he was, you know, the naff soap opera of his time.
Yeah, I think that's kind of bollocks.
Really?
When you look at,
I know that when you look, like, at, it would have been like a week's work salary to go and see one of his plays or something. So it wasn't cheap for them, but it was for that audience.
We should probably talk about this in another episode, because the nature of drama changed wildly during Shakespeare's lifetime. So you know what it was being used for at the beginning was quite different to what it was being used for at the end and in between. And
there's even a reason for
why there was such a demand for cinema, for, sorry, drama at that time. Mm-hmm. But it has to do with the church. But going
spoiler
back to
alert.
Dickens. Spoiler alert. Going back to Dickens. I get it. And, you know, for me, Thackeray is the one who's unreadable. So I've tried to read Vanity Fair a couple times. Just can't get through it. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to go back to it at some point and love it. Because I remember I had to start and give up on Crime and Punishment three times before it actually really grabbed me. And that's a book that kind of owned me for such a long time. But I don't know. I would try to suggest maybe try and get past that. Maybe not even reading it, but trying to find one of the good BBC dramas that they've done. The Little Dorrit one was quite good. They did Bleak House that had Scully in it. That was quite good.
Scully?
Our mutual friend.
You mean?
Yeah. Gillian Anderson.
Right. Yeah.
As a Brit, who she keeps insisting that she is, and she probably is as well. She does really well in that, I would say. Although it is a bit of an ambiguous performance, it is kind of divisive. But I would say, if you're getting hung up on the syntax of Dickens, then to definitely try to get a step back from that.
Yeah,
somehow.
That's a good way of putting it. I think that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Because, like I say, there are way more harsh criticisms of Dickens than just that he's overwritten. And especially with Oliver Twist, which is kind of a funny one.
Funny what you were saying about the ending and how everything's so convenient, because that's also why I dislike Tintin. He's just like some kid who everyone thinks is amazing, but actually when you look at what his journalism and all the crimes and whatever that he solves, all the evidence just lands on his lap, you know. If I was as lucky as him, I'd be a genius too. Anyway,
Let's
not get
into this. We get told that he's a journalist, but we don't ever see him write anything. He doesn't send stories off or reports anywhere.
He writes down in a little notebook. That makes him a journalist.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, he journals. But right. Hergé doesn't even use it as a plot to kind of say, oh yeah, my newspaper is paying for me to go here. He just, you know, randomly walks onto ships and they take him places. You're absolutely right. I hadn't thought about that until now.
Yeah.
But okay, sorry, getting back to Dickens. So what can we say about Dickens? This went in a completely different direction than I thought it would, but that's awesome.
Okay, so tell me, what is it? Tell me more about how it's so emotional. Give me an example of how it really hit you.
It's hard to, because you can't kind of just say the events, because you have to experience the characters and kind of see them live on page. And for all the things that Dickens explicitly says, there's as much going on that he does not say. And that goes down to, even the ones that you don't hear people talk about very much, like Dombey and Son was the last one I read. And there was, it turned into, at the end, this amazing duality with this woman who was getting revenge on her mother by marrying someone who she knew would annoy her and controlling him in a way that he was submissive to, but he was controlling her in another way that she was being submissive to. But then also there was another layer of, he had a daughter who he was basically abusing by neglect, who she said, I'm going to rescue this daughter so that what happens to her isn't what happened to me. But at the same time, she's being iced out by this husband who's starting to realize that she's taking an attachment to this, to his daughter, who he's completely ignoring. So he's going to try to get at her by being hard on the daughter again. Then she realizes this is happening. So it gets really deeply psychological in a very short amount of time. And that is something which is literally masterful. Just to play with those layers of emotion and to have so many things be up in the air and to have these characters who you hate do good things, you know, these good characters do bad things, and then just, you know, have the fate of this young girl at stake. It was edge of the seat kind of stuff.
Okay, well, I'll have to give it another go, I think. I'll try an audiobook.
I always suggest people do Tale of Two Cities, because I think that's Dickens at his best. Much shorter than much of the other stuff. It's, you know, what we would consider a normal novel length these days, maybe 300 pages, depending on your edition, maybe 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. Get an audiobook by all means. Get an unabridged one. It ties in a very convenient way, so you get the full Dickens experience with all the coincidences. And you have the very famous poetical opening and then the very famous poetical ending, which I'm not going to spoil for you. And it does have the nobility. It has the weakness of humanity. It's got it all, really. And it takes place during the French Revolution. So I don't see what there is to complain about with that one.
Cool. Okay. Well, I will do that.
I could talk about Dickens for so much longer. Okay. No, that's fine. If you like Dickens, write in. If you don't like Dickens, shut up. But yeah, just...
no, if you like don't like Dickens, let us know. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll take a listener poll. Yes, we should do a hashtag so people can get involved and we can read out some of the better comments. So what mm-hmm. should we make our hashtag? Hashtag fiction hack?
Yeah, hashtag fiction hack.
That'll reach
us. That's the title.
So we got to remember to subscribe to that hashtag or something, right?
Yes, that sounds like a good thing to do.
Cool. Okay. Let's
wrap it up. So where can they find us, Colin?
Well, we've already done that bit at the beginning. Remember, We can remind people. So you can find us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter as Colin_Munro. That's MUNRO. Mm-hmm. That's the original Scottish way of spelling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm colinmunro.me.uk is the website. And you can also find show notes there and things. So what about you?
Yep, I'm at Ross Lawhead. That's all one word. Lawhead is spelled Lawhead. That's the original Scottish way of writing it. And I've also got a website. It is actually a Scottish name.
Is it? All right.
We can go into that. That's a whole other episode. No, it's not a whole other episode.
We're not going to do an episode about your name, Ross.
No, it's there's a Lawhead farm and a Lawhead house about half an hour south of Edinburgh.
Okay.
And it's a part of the Lockhart clan.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I've never heard your name other than within your family.
It's weird, isn't it? I think it's because they changed it when they hopped on the boat to America.
Yeah.
Some people went Lockheed. There's Liz Lockheed, who's a poet. Ah, that's so the same name.
Lockheed, it's not, I don't think it's the same family.
Related. Hmm. But yeah, Lockheed Martin. Yeah, again, that went the other way when they came to the States.
Uh-huh. And it's the same with Munro. That's why mm-hmm. the alternative spelling exists.
It's got an E at the end of it.
And with an O, you know? With an O instead of a U.
Oh, right. I got you. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Language is awesome.
Yes. Yeah. Words. It's very interesting.
Speaking words, language.
Yeah. Now, do we know what next episode is going to be about? Have we had any thoughts about that?
I don't think so. We can open it up to listeners if they've got an idea, or we'll just decide among ourselves when we come to it.
Yeah,
we got some possibilities. What were some of the things that came out of this episode and last episode?
I've got a list.
Oh, Chekhov's gun. I like the Chekhov's gun idea because that's got a lot of because we could bring Hitchcock into it, J.J. Abrams, and a lot of modern storytelling.
Mm-hmm. We've also really talked about doing an episode on Winnie the Pooh, Black Panther, Game of Thrones, Doctor Who, Aristotle's Poetics, Superman, mm-hmm. Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things. If any of those sound interesting to you, listeners, then give us a hashtag and let us know. Maybe you can do a poll. Maybe you can do a poll. I know you've done Facebook or Twitter polls in the past about things. In fact, you did one about, didn't you do one about whether or not you should actually start this podcast, although back then it was going to be a book. But then that became this podcast.
Yeah, I asked
if
people wanted to know my thoughts about Star Wars, and that turned into this. Yeah. So who knows where it's going to end up. Yeah, if people tell us about an episode they want to hear, we'll probably write a book about it. We just don't know.
Yeah. But, is there anything else about Star Wars you want to get off your chest before we go?
not right now. I should just stop picking at it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay.
And we'll see you next week.
Time. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I just hung up on him and I meant to stop the recording.